You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. The Baha'i writings say that music sung or played is spiritual food for the soul and heart. My guests today are Genevieve and Eric Dozier, gifted musicians and vocalists whose life and work together personifies this profound teaching. Steeped in the blues and gospel musical traditions of the Deep South and inspired by the transcendent teachings of the Baha'i faith, their co-creative partnership elucidates the transformative power of music and its ability to help mend the frayed and tattered garment of a bewildered and disunified humanity. With thread in hand, their musical instruments, and two daughters, Justice and Worthington, in tow, the Doziers are embarking on a musical adventure across the nation to promote racial reconciliation and the eradication of the baneful scourge of bigotry and injustice. As the brilliant multi-instrumentalist, vocalist, and composer Stevie Wonder once said, "What I'm not confused about is the world needing much more love. No hate, no prejudice, no bigotry, and more unity, peace, and understanding, period." Genevieve and Eric Dozier, it is my pleasure to welcome you to America's Most Challenging Issue.
Well, thank you so much, man. I'm glad to be here, and we're glad to be here, and very excited to talk with you, and also to hear some of the things that you're doing as well, man. You're doing your thing. I'm always proud to see a brother just in that, you know, in the space and living into their calling. You know, that's one of the things that my grandfather used to tell me all the time. He says, "Whatever you do, you know, don't live beneath your calling." And so, you know, I've tried to live my life according to that. And I love to see, brothers and sisters doing the same. So, man, I'm proud of you, man. I was proud of you.
That's right back at you, brother. That's right back at you. And, speaking about callings, man, I mean, I want to hear about this Great American Race Unity Road Trip, man. Y'all got to break that down for me, man. So what is this Great American Race Unity Road Trip?
Well, let's see. What is it? So essentially, at the beginning of this summer, Genevieve, myself, and the two girls were invited to come and do some work in North Carolina, as well as the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. And so we all got in the van, went to these places, and while we were there, we were doing kind of a combination of concerts. I was presenting my flagship program, which is Musical Journeys Through American Race Relations. We were working with kids, heavily involved with families, in particular around the discussions around the racial discourse in America. And we got the crazy idea that we should be doing this at least for the next year. But I think that a lot of that was inspired by the fact that so many times with artists, you know, artists come into communities and then they leave after a day. They come in and do what they do, and then and then they go. Mm-hmm. One of my dear friends, Mayor Mansouri, who is the founder of the Children's, one of the co-founders of Children's Theater in New York City, said she said this about me when I was probably in my 20s, early 30s, or whatnot, is that you just can't come into communities, dazzle, and then disappear. Mm. Is that the work is too vital. You need to find a way to be with communities for longer periods of time and engage in this work. And so I think that for us, what the Great American Race Unity Road Trips represents is not just going to communities and doing performances, but engaging with communities in the deep work of racial reconciliation, which means that in order for us to do that, we really need to extend our time. So what it really is a series of extended artist residencies in these communities that help communities begin to think a little more deeply about the racial discourse as it happens around the dinner table and with families and in schools and with children. So the three areas of focus of the road trip, one is to engage at the level of family. Two is to equip children and young people to engage in this discourse as well. Mm-hmm. And three, to gather communities across generations, across religious lines, across racial lines, to engage in spirited interfaith family devotional gatherings. Mm-hmm. And so those are our three areas of focus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, man, we have these discussions in so many different forums, whether they be academic, whether they be in community organizing spaces and things like that. But listen, if home is where the heart is, then we need to be where the heart is having this conversation. Mm-hmm. And so primary focus of the work is with families, because that's where we're spending time with each other. That's where we're breaking bread. That's where we're having our arguments. That's where we're having our debates. Mm-hmm. That's where we're raising our children. And so that's kind of how the project was conceived.
You know, I was so excited to hear about this initiative, you know, that you're undertaking. I thought the concept, first of all, was just brilliant. And given the divisive nature of our current national discourse, you know, it just seemed, just incredibly timely.
Yeah.
And while I admire your courage and your dedication, I mean, this is not easy, right? Traveling across the country with two small children is quite an undertaking. So I wanted to know why this work and why now?
You know, I know that if I'm going to do this work, I can't do it without my ladies.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
But I had been a little hesitant about, you know, wanting to really engage in the work. And so really Genevieve was the engine that kind of kicked it off. So I'll let her speak, ask her to speak to the why, you know, why she wanted her family on the road like that.
I'm a prayer for one. So I have many conversations with my grandmother. My grandmother was the example for our family when it came to this work. And, you know, we witnessed her being obedient to the cause of racial unity. And, you know, she moved into Black communities and she lived with Black people. She had Black folks in her home. They were family. And so I was a witness to that. And I continue to pray and ask her for assistance in this work.
What years are we talking about, Genevieve, when she was doing this kind of work? What years are
we? Watts riots years.
Wow. Yeah.
Moving her family into Watts at the height of the civil rights era unrest and when I look at that as a, you know, as a Black man growing up in this country, and I look at that level of courage, it says something to me about a family's culture. And not only that, you see what it produces, because like when you look at Genevieve's family, you have people in her family that are Black American, that are Iranian, that are Mexican, that are Chinese, you know, and I think that by her grandmother taking on that work of racial unity and racial justice, you know, it permeates the culture of the family, and it literally integrated their dinner table.
Wow.
So that just being on the outside looking in on that, to me, says something because you know, they're working it out where the rubber hits the road. It's one mm-hmm. thing that you care about Black people. Mm. It's another thing when it's your grandchildren mm. that is to mm. because you engage at a whole different level. I didn't mm. mean to cut you off.
That's okay.
If you yeah. want to mm. Wow. Wow. So she was not, clearly this was not a woman who was lacking in courage or determination.
No. She just was so motivated. You know, she mm. would make a decision and she followed through.
Mm.
You know, to ask her for assistance in serving.
Mm-hmm.
I know that she guided this guy into my life.
Hmm.
We're going on 8 years of marriage.
It'll be nine.
Sunday,
nine.
Eight.
Is it eight or nine?
It's going to be seven.
It's eight.
8 years on Sunday. And I've seen Eric. I've seen him try and just, you know, have a regular job here mm-hmm. or, you know, to figure out what he's going to do to take care of his family. Mm-hmm. But what I've also seen in nearly these 8 years, how he's able to bring people together in a room and how he's able to transform the hearts and the minds within a 3-hour workshop. So, and he's very humble, so you'll never hear him talk about himself like this. I get to talk about him.
Mm.
So he knows how to do this work. Mm-hmm. He knows how to bring people in a living room, in a restaurant, in a coffee house. It could be mm. anywhere. We will be singing together within 5 minutes. And he knows how to talk about this racial discourse and basically racial prejudice. You call it what you want. He knows how to talk about it and in a way that's not threatening,
mm.
that people don't get defensive, or it's important what he's doing. The work that he does is so important. And I'm just, the world needs to see it.
Mm.
So for me, this was a really easy decision of, we have to do this. Our children get to experience witnessing mm. this work.
Mm.
They get to be immersed in these family settings and in the spiritual aspect of it. And we just get to be together. We get to go mm. into communities, wherever it is, and all be together and all heal together and transform together and be uplifted and be excited. And mm-hmm. there's so many words. So I'm more of just trying to support his work mm-hmm. by doing this as a family.
Mm, wow, that's wonderful. Well, we know what a critical component that is, because he couldn't be doing what he's doing if he didn't have that foundation of support. So, you know, God bless you and thank you for the work that you're doing in regards to this. So really important. Now, you both are, you know, accomplished individuals, whether that be as musicians, vocalists, other aspects of your life, with a long history of using your gifts with an orientation towards service, right? Mm-hmm. Baha'i Faith emphasizes again and again the significance of service in the development of the soul. In the context of the faith, service is the highest standard of human achievement, right? It's mm-hmm. not accolades, it's not fame, it's service. Yeah. And we're living through some troubling times, right? Particularly in regards to the issue of race, which the Baha'i writings describe as America's most challenging issue, hence the name of this show. And I'm wondering, what function of service does music fulfill in helping to ameliorate the difficulties we are facing? Mm. What magical quality do these notes, these melodies, these voices possess that seem to provide so much comfort through troubling times?
Mm. Well, I mean, as you mentioned in the intro about the Black American music in particular, and you quoted Stevie Wonder, who was a product of that. You know, I am a firm believer And I have been taught all of my life that when music goes out and it does work.
Mm-hmm.
Like it does something. It does something to people's hearts and to their soul. Mm-hmm. It goes out and it acts on our humanness. And so to employ music as the primary context for this work is not only something that I think is aesthetically and sonically pleasing to people, but it's also strategic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a strategy behind it, and that's why our foremothers and forefathers employed that music to not only just be something that soothed their soul, but something that went out and acted upon the spirits of other people. You know, Frederick Douglass talks about this. He says that if you want to understand the true nature of the chattel slavery system, you should go down to Colonel Lloyd's farm and listen to the tones that are coming out of the slave quarters. And he said, if you're not moved by those tones, he said that there's no flesh on your obdurate heart. That man had a way with words.
Yes, he did.
And then there's also the issue too, is that the music is a carrier of not just information, but it's a carrier of a social theory as well. So I think about engaging people in the practice of call and response. So I say something, you know, this is the light of mine, and they sing, I'm gonna let it shine, you know, like a call and response type of thing. What that represents to me is much more than just a theory of music, but that is a communicative framework. It says something about what I think about your participation in my art and how I value your contribution to it. So I value someone else's contribution to my existence so much that I'm going to allow them to shape me in real time, right here and right now. Now, what if we looked at individuals like that when we're engaged in this racial dialogue and in this racial discourse? What if we looked at every individual sitting across the table from us as a contributor in shaping our humanity? And what if the relationship was one of reciprocity? Not just trying to win an argument, but realizing that as we're engaged in this consultative discourse, that we have a power within us to create something that has yet to be seen. Like to me, that music and the practice of that music since I came out of the womb, that particular practice has actually taught me how to be with human beings. So it's not just that we have to have, you know, black people, white people, all different people in the room. But, you know, when people get in this room together, we have to realize that there are certain things that other cultures have learned in dealing with racism and learning how to manage manage this discourse that we need to know. So it's not for the photo op, you know, because diversity doesn't necessarily imply that there's equity in the space. You know, I always tell people that plantations were diverse. You know, like plantations were diverse, residential schools were diverse, culturally, generationally, racially, all these different things, but they were also dysfunctional and inequitable. So part of bringing these cultural contributions to communities, which a lot of times tend to be, you know, in Baha'i spaces, tend to be predominantly white, predominantly Persian, and sharing these cultural ways of knowing, these cultural ways of being, these cultural ways of expression as a means of healing is also a way for us to promote justice in that space. You know, so music is a way. It's like Billy Preston said, you know, he wrote a song years ago, and my brother J.B. Echol introduced me to this song. Billy Preston said, everybody likes some kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it be jazz, gospel, country, whatever. And so music becomes the doorway. It becomes the entry point to really embark upon a deeper dive around the racial chorus. But it also activates a different center of knowing for people as well.
You know,
we from you know, a lot of academic studies are starting to speak to this now, that music actually is, it is, if one of the fastest, if not the fastest way to social bonding. So that's why you see people beginning to use music in the workplace, to employ music more in their justice work. It's the reason why the civil rights activists sung. You know, they sung to get their courage up, but they also sung because they knew that it opened up a heart center of knowing. And so if you can, if you capture that heart, you know, then you begin to fuel that fire in people that will give them the courage to actually stand up and do the work and get off their butts and stop just talking.
I love that. It, you know, it makes me think about the different kind of literacies, ways of knowing, right? That came over with the enslaved African in the belly of the slave ship. And of course, we're talking about, you know, of course, there's the spoken or the linguistic literacies, which is, to the Western mind, is the most easy to understand. But the more complex are those more spiritual literacies, you know, those things that that vibrate in the heart. And, you know, those sonic literacies and the ability to pass knowledge and information, you know, through those various literacies, I think is a very, very, it's just an ingenious coded system of, coded system, you know, that it imparts information and also inspires the soul. So,
I mean, it's so true, man, because, you know, I think too is that, you know, I grew up in the Black American church tradition. So the thing is that all of those contexts were predominantly Black American. I mean, that's Black church. That's what the Black church is. And so, you know, the thing that I appreciate now, particularly having been a Baha'i now for 25 years, is that I get to bring that knowledge, that cultural way of being, into multicultural context to see how it lives in an alternative space. And the thing is what I found is that there are a lot of people on this planet that need to and want to be free. And there are a lot of people that think they're free, but they're not. And so if that music is about anything, it's about freedom, it's about justice, it's about expression. And like you said, is that it is another way of philosophically and emotionally knowing the world that people need to know. And you find that dynamic, you know, like you said, you find it, you know, not only in the music, but in the art, in the facility with textiles. You think about African American quilting and all these different things where they would weave maps into the quilts, or weave pads to freedom into their hair. You know, and there are a lot of Black and Indigenous cultures and Aboriginal cultures that have these keen senses of knowing that you won't find in a history book. Like, you know, Douglas said that too. He said that you will find more in the music than you will find in 1,000 volumes of philosophy books. So that's heavy, man. And so that's why music is such a central part of what we're doing.
Is
because people have to understand that there are multiple literacies.
Genevieve, I'm interested in African American musical tradition comes out of the field hollers, you know, the spirituals, the gospels, the blues. And we know, you know, although it comes out of that cultural context, it's not just for Black folk, it's for everybody. And it sounds like to me, like you know, your experience with your grandmother exposed you to probably some of this musical tradition. And I'm wondering how you, you know, as you're a white woman, and how that musical tradition resonates for you. Where does that land in your heart and your spirit? How does that, how does your engagement with that traditional, that with that tradition impact you?
You know, I didn't really, to be honest, I didn't really understand like the history. Like I understand it from being married to him. For me, I think like my mom, my mom had me watch Roots at the age of seven.
At seven years old. Wow.
You know, just being raised with the truth. I think my young soul as a little girl always just felt a connection to the pain and suffering of Black people. And through that, you know, I think it was more of that human suffering placed upon people just because of the color of their skin. It was more of a personal connection with that rather than the music as a young child. So I was definitely attracted to like some of the R&B stuff as a child.
Of course.
you know,
Give me some names.
Well, like Michael Jackson, of course.
That's good.
And you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Like, it was more of those, like the 70s and 80s, I think.
Yeah.
And I think being exposed to like the Baha'i Youth Workshop that was in the 70s and 80s, there was that music component with a lot of these Black artists that was just really like every time some songs come on from like the workshop days, it just takes me right back there when I was a child and witnessing. And for those that don't know about the LA Baha'i Youth Workshop in the 70s and 80s, it was just youth, you know, dancing and promoting racial justice and unity, equality between men and women through the art of dance and music.
So
I got to witness that as a young child. My family, you know, all music people. I come from the Seals and Crofts family. My father was an engineer. And so inspiration, I think, from Jimmy and Dash.
So for our listeners who don't know who, sadly don't know who Seals and Crofts, you know, were, can you just unpack that just a little bit?
Well, and your grandmother's connection to
them. My grandmother was their manager. So they were, you know, at their height in the 70s. You know, they sang Summer Breeze. Hummingbird, Diamond Girl. That's my family.
Oh, man. Those brothers could groove. They really could groove.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So, and I tell my story. I don't know if I should share this about my experience when I moved to Tennessee. It's an interesting experience.
I think you should. Why not? Go right ahead. Yeah, please.
Being raised as a child in Los Angeles, my family, you know, and my best friends that lived across the street were Black and Mexican. And my parents decided to move. I think my whole family decided to just kind of, you know, take a break from the LA life and move out. My family moved to Tennessee. So my father could still be in the music business. And we had a friend here. We moved to a town outside of Nashville. We basically moved to an all white neighborhood. And for me, I was 11 years old. And one of the first questions I asked my mom is where are the Black people? Like I didn't think there were any Black people at all in the South. You know, where did I just move to? You know, I left my family and I moved to an all white racist community. I never heard the N word till I moved here.
You
know, I was told I was going to hell for being a Baha'i at 11 years old. It was such a culture shock and a spiritual shock to my system. And I remember I just remember believing, you know, not there's just no black people in Tennessee. Okay, and I was 17 years old, and I heard about a teen nightclub in Nashville. Mm-hmm. So I drove 30 minutes to Nashville at 17 years old, and there were black people in the club. I was like, oh my God, my family, I found my family, you know. I just, needless to say, I was really excited, mm-hmm. but it was a definitely, I guess I'd never met black folks that were terrified of white people.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I made fast friends with some folks, and they were, the first time they were going to come to my house, I had to drag them in to meet my white parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I never, you know, this was in the late 80s.
Yeah.
So it was heartbreaking to me. I never stopped learning, and I never stopped feeling. I think for me, though, my disposition and my nature is that I'm pretty shy.
Yeah.
So I've never known how to do this kind of work on my own.
Yeah.
And so I know that I really strongly believe that that's why my grandmother guided Eric into my life, is because I've been begging her in the next world to help me serve and do this work. I don't know how to do it by myself.
Now
I'm like, I don't have to do it by myself.
Yeah. And
Eric is, I'm so safe with him. Like, I can ask him questions, my naive questions at times. I've learned about the history of where music comes from, you know, in its truest form.
Yeah.
And so I'm feeling pretty blessed.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, it's amazing to me, because this is, you know, your story and what you've shared is such a, there's such a congruency with the work that you're engaged in now. I mean, that seems to be the reason why you are on this great American, you know, race unity war road trip, you know? You know, it's just been so enjoyable to be able to spend this time with you all and just learn from your experience, both of your experiences, how they inform each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're getting short on time, but, you know, before we close, you know, I just have to ask you both, you know, what do you hope the end result of this experience will be, you know, for you and for the country? And I'd love to hear that response from the both of you, from each of you. Yeah.
I think for me, you know, I'm a mom of small girls, so I have to go with the top is just our children doing this work with us, and knowing that this is going to be something they remember for the rest of their lives. This is going to cause an impact on them. And so far, the communities that we visit, like our youngest especially,
yeah,
she's a light in the community. So what our children have to offer to other children in the communities we visit is so crucial and important too, because, you know, the children, they're going to be the youth, and then they're going to be grown-ups, you know? So for me, I'm talking from a mother's point. My hope is the great and powerful effect that it will have on my girls and the influences of other children that we visit in all of the communities.
Wow, it's wonderful. Wow.
I mean, I think for me, you know, also what, like, speaking as a parent, as a father of young brown girls, is that they need to be safe. And right now, as we have seen, you know, across the planet, this, you know, what I think what racism and white supremacy essentially does is it diminishes people's capacity to care for other people. And that's what makes it so insidious and dangerous, is that it slowly corrodes your empathy. And if you can't feel for somebody else because of the color of their skin, then you can engage in harming them a lot easier. And so to be in someone's home, to be with groups of people, to be black or brown in spaces that are predominantly white, I think it's essential, you know, not just from the point of, making the space a little bit more diverse, but to come into that space and to be who we are as a family, as a unit that is working on this issue every day. I think it's important for people to see that, you know, very important for people to see that. And so, you know, what we're really trying to do is capture the people's hearts, because if you can get the heart, they'll do the work.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you both for the work that you're doing, the powerful example that the both of you are setting. You know, I think from just the mere presence of the both of you being in the same space and being together is a testament to the power of the oneness of mankind. And then you add on top of that the really fascinating and creatively brilliant work that you're engaged in. I mean, man, that's a lot of power, boy. That's a lot of power. So I love you both. I appreciate you both. And, you know, we want to encourage any of our listeners out there who want to learn more about the Great American Race Unity Road Trip, and also to consider making a contribution towards this important work, to visit Eric Dozier. That's Eric, one word, E-R-I-C, Dozier, D-O-Z-I-E-R, one word, .com/roadtrip. And you can learn more about this amazing endeavor, and if you so choose, also support it. You've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, the revelation of Baha'u'llah, whose supreme mission is none other but the achievement of the organic and spiritual unity of the whole body of nations, should, if we be faithful to its implications, be regarded as signalizing through its advent the coming of age of the entire human race. From the Baha'i Writings, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.